Okay, good. So let's learn. Fine. So last time we did the beginning of the reasons for Shemitah, right? So let's review the ones we saw, okay? You guys who are inside, that's fine too. So what did we see? So one possibility based on the reference in Shmuel Chav Gimel to poor people led to some people believing that what? Yeah, the Rambam says it's to take care of the poor people. We said, first of all, there's a problem with it. Right, what's the problem with it? What's the problem with it linguistically there, literarily?
Is that the punishments are very severe.
So that's later. That's if you read it in context of Vayikra Chavav, it's like, okay, if it's for the poor, okay, maybe that would be deserve punishment. So no, so, right, so that's not such a problem. God takes it very seriously, the poor. What's the problem?
The problem with it is that it's not, it says more that, and then this happened.
Right, so first of all, it's just vi'achu evyoneyamech, right? It doesn't sound necessarily like causation. It doesn't have l'man like the next pasuk, right? Second of all, it's also the animals, right? So it makes it sound like it's not just the poor people, it's for the ganze island, whatever, right? In addition, in Vayikra Chavhei, which is the main parak, it says nothing about poor people. It says everyone will eat it, right? Furthermore, what does it say there? It calls it Shabbat l'Hashem, right? Seems to be something about God, right, rather than just some social thing, right? So there's a lot of problems with that. Okay, so what are the reasons do we get, right? So the Rambam had another reason based on Shabbat Haaretz. What did he say?
Practical,
right? Rest the land. There, we had several problems with the notion that it's just for the land to rest, such as why is it such a bad punishment if it's just for the land to rest? Furthermore, right, some of the Mevarshim said, but wait a second, it's overworking it in the sixth year. So how could that be good? Furthermore, right, you rotate more than every 6 years, right? And
if the punishment is exile, then the guy might not work even.
Yeah, and if it's exile and then the land is going to be decimated, it's going to be shmama, why is that good? Hey, Shlomo.
What's shmama?
See, you were back exactly at 11. But we had to start a little bit early. But
it's because of me, so it's...
You are forgiven. Sorry, what's your name?
David Lifter.
Nice to meet you.
His father was my rav before we made Aliyah.
His father was my employer before I came back. So I worked at the Bayit for 3 years. So.
You did? What year?
3 years ago.
Seven years ago.
There you go. You
have a so, hi, everybody. I met some of you. Which one is Simon if he's here? He's inside because I know that's his roommate. So, all right, I'll send regards.
Where do you live?
In Carnation Row.
Very nice. Yeah. Oh, you just used your driving back?
I drove him back, and I have to work out that I have a customer to see.
Yeah, perfect.
Perfect. Right, I don't want to disturb this year, but...
Well, nice to meet you. But you lived up in... You're up in Thornhill.
Right.
Are you related to Rabbi Lipner?
No.
No. Okay.
No. That's another story I'll tell you when I next see you.
Okay, fine. I look forward.
Take care, Shlomo. Take care, Rabbi.
Marchatima tova. Okay, good. So that's the problem with the land one. Plus, right, why is the Torah just giving pragmatic advice? Yalla. Fine. What else do we have? So far, doing review so far. For you haven't missed anything. Yep. What? Okay, good. So the other clue is Vayikra Chavhei focuses on Shabbat LaHashem. So what does Shabbat LaHashem mean? So we have the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says, right, Kidei Shetedu Sha'aretz Shelis, you know the land is God's. That's a good reason for it to be punished with galut, right? Rashi has a slight variation on it, which is that you shouldn't be, you know, taken away with wealth and stuff like that.
But
that's a very good reason, right? If the land is mine, you don't recognize it, go away. Yes, it does, right? Meaning you could have just said that it means that the land is mine, right? Rashi takes a variant on it, which is no, you'll know that it's mine, right? And you won't be led astray by wealth, right? Now, that could be related, right? That if you're wealthy, you'll think it's all about you, you'll forget the God, right, runs the land. He's influenced by Dvarim, Zoram Parchet, I think, right? And the Torah Tumima, right, says this is why it's heretical. Okay, fine, right? That's why it's so bad. Okay, good. What other reasons did we do last time? Oh, right, we gave another possibility. That what does Shabbat Ha'aretz, Shabbat LaHashem mean? Not that you recognize God, but I think it was Kobe's, right? And this is said by several Mepharshim, which is, no, what does it mean Shabbat LaHashem? It's not just that you'll recognize God, but what?
A Shabbat for God.
Right, meaning not a Shabbat to recognize God, but a Shabbat for God, meaning if you stop working, then you'll take up time and do godly things, like learn Torah, right? Whatever, you'll go to Kobe for a year. Right, and Kobe had said, just like the Torah says, right, there's a parallel to Shabbat, right, that just like the Torah, right? Okay. Now, again, I didn't give you all, as you can see, right, these are just some of the sources I printed out for myself in addition, right, and there's others, but this is what I needed something to read during the fast day, right, so I printed this out. This is, by the way, an excellent website if you ever want, like, this is alhatorah.org, right, and they just have all the sources, and very nice.
They just have, like, all the sources for any topic?
On Tanakh, they just do, and then they give you a summary, say like this, right, you can see what they do.
They organize it for you, too?
Introduction,
oh.
Questions, summary, approaches, exegetical approaches, problems with it, defenses, and then, if you want, all the sources, right? So, yes, it's an excellent, excellently done website. So I printed out there so I'd have some more. So it's not only then, just to give you some other people's takes about Torah, right? Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor says, V'yavo chulam shem knuyim v'yishmu'u et ha-Torah. Right, Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, late mid Baal HaTosfot, right, Parashat Tanakh. I went through all of it, so you don't have to. I also like it; they don't cut out the one-liners; they just put it all here, so you actually have to read it if you want to look at the sources. Okay. So those are the ones we've seen so far. But let's do some more, okay? Okay, what else? What else did you guys see, either in the Mefarshim or in the Pesukim, right? We didn't yet read Dvarim, right? The passage in Dvarim. Let's read that Dvarim Perek Tedvav and see what that might give us. So what does the Pesukim imply in Dvarim Tedvav? Second. Right, Dvarim Tedvav, let me read it for you. Miketz Sheva Shanim Tazeh Shemitah. The end of 7 years, you'll do Shemitah. So first of all, in Dvarim, right, this was another thing we picked on last week. In Shmot, the name of the year is Shvi'it, right? In Vayikra, it's usually Shabbat, right? Shabbat Aret, Shabbat Lashem. In Dvarim, it does seem to be called Shemitah as a proper noun. If you borrow money, you got to relinquish claims over it, and you cannot claim the loan from your friend. Ed hanagri, he goes, but what about the non-Jew? If you lend money to a non-Jew, you're allowed to claim it. You're allowed to, right, during Shemitah. Because no, that there will always be poor people in Israel. And if you keep the mitzvah, you'll lend money to other people. You won't need to borrow money. Right, and then he says, right, that if you skip down a few pesukim, and he warns you in the context of lending money that when Shemitah is coming, what might you be tempted to do? You might have a horrible thing in your heart to say the Shemitah is coming, and therefore and you will therefore not give money to the poor person, and God will, he'll cry out to God, and it'll be a sin for you. Naton titenlo, give him money. Give him money, and God will bless you. Now, in this context, what seems to be the rationale for Shemitah? There does seem to be a lot of emphasis on the poor person, but
charity,
whatever. Except, what is the focus of these pesukim in Shemitah? Shemitah Ksafim, right? What we call Shemitah Ksafim, the loan part of it. Does it say anything about the agricultural one?
Not really.
No. So therefore, you could say that the Shemitah Ksafim side is for the poor people, right? But the Shemitah Aretz is for other goals. Or you could say that Shemitah Ksafim teaches us what all of Shemitah is about, right? Including, right, Shemitah Karka, right? So that could be part of the conversation, okay? Good. But what other reasons did you get? What other reasons did you get for Shemitah? We've done four. What else? Did you see any hybrid positions? Ah, very good. So first of all, you could just say multiple, right? But you could also not just say multiple, but say that these are not just additive, but they're actually, right? They're actually synthesized, right? They're synthesized. So did you see anybody who said a synthetic svara? Or do you have a svara, even if you don't remember who it said or you didn't see it?
Basically, you
very good. Right, so the Shor HaMor, which I hadn't given you the original sources, but since all of you got to the sources so fast, right, great, I gave you the Shor HaMor. Right, the Shor HaMor is wonderful, because I think the Shor HaMor is really an attempt to synthesize them. So, right, what does the Shor HaMor say? Second. Right, he says as follows. Ulefi HaNigle, Hu Shoresh Kol HaTorah Kula V'Yesod HaOlam Kula. What's the reason for it? And this is the basis of the whole Torah. Ki ha'olam yefshar litkayem elei maniyim ve'ashirim. The world will always have poor and rich. Uve'inyan ha'shmitah v'ha'yovel ratza Hashem yitbarach shiyu shavim aniyim ve'ashirim. He said the point is not to take care of the poor, right? Now that's not the point. What's the point? To teach the rich what it feels like to be poor. Okay, so first of all, right, how? Ki dechtiv. He said a poor person is always
hungry,
trying to get food. He doesn't know where, right? He's nothing to eat. He's always looking to God, because his life is hanging in the balance. And he every morning he says, oh, right, wait till evening, right? Meaning he always, right, just get through it. The Hashir, on the other hand, a rich person, and the rich person always has food, right? We're all rich, right? We're all rich. But we really are, right? By historical definitions, right? Right, meaning they had done these studies, that even if you take into account inflation, right? Until, like, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the average family, right, lived on the equivalent of something like a dollar a day, right, for most of history, right, even with inflation. Not like, right, a dollar a day, $3 a day, different study, whatever, right, meaning basically nothing. Yes, like, if you take into inflation and you do it in modern terms, that's how much people were living on, right? We're phenomenally wealthy by historical standards.
Well, that's not true. That just means, like, dollar just
on its value. No. If you take into account inflation,
even in
meaning if you transfer what they had into modern money,
oh, okay.
They had the equivalent of like $1 to $3 a day. That's it. That's taking into in terms of how difficult it was to have food and things like that. Right?
How do you budget that to live?
You don't. You starve
die.
To death. That's why people were dying until the Industrial Revolution. Right? That's why the average age was, right? That was why, remember, it's not that people couldn't live until their 60s, 70s, 80s. They could. Why was the average lifespan until, like, the 1800s 40? Because so many people died in either during childbirth or disease or whatever when they were kids. Because there was no food, there was no health, there was no nothing. Right?
Even for poor people nowadays, they have better living standards.
Yes, of course. And definitely in Western cultures, most poor people have higher living standards than, like, at least middle-of-the-road people.
You've got to keep in mind that even, like, kings back in the day didn't have indoor plumbing.
Yes! Yes! Fine. Yeah. So then he says, "V'lachem ratzat Torah la'avishnat ha'shmita v'yovel sh'yishnei ratzim ritzufim k'dushot." And therefore you have shmita, and sometimes shmita plus yovel. V'ofen shafilu ha'ashir notei inav l'shamayin. That even the rich person will have to turn to heaven. Achar in zorim v'kotrim v'omer ma'ochel ma'asek, because you're not planting, so he'll say, what am I going to eat? K'dei she'yeda v'yizkor tzar ha'ani shekol yamav u'shnotav v'tzaru v'daga. So he'll remember what it's like to be poor. And after 2-3 years of living like a poor person, Omer, Ma'atel Anche Beidi, Gain Lizra Lektor, Ma'at Anisha, Koyim Ha'machavim Midoch Haraniyot. One day he'll wake up and say, Kaval! Right? What? Because you haven't been planting for 2 years, so the third year they're also within food. Right? If you have Yovel. Right? Shemitah, Yovel, and then the year after, right? But Ofen, Shir, Yir'eh, Atmo, Ba'oshro, Yizkor, Yamim, Shavru, Lav, Me'esh, Midav, Yovel. Right? Okay, good. What is the benefit of the Tzor HaMoras Beirish? Chaim. What's the benefit of the Tzor HaMoras Beirish? Why don't you at least move this way? You're like behind the glass. At least closer. Right? What's the benefit of the Tzor HaMoras Beirish? What problems does he solve? It's a very clever Beirish because it solves a lot of problems. What does it solve?
The fact that I'm very church today.
That doesn't solve that problem. That would either be sleeping or coffee if you do coffee. Right? No, two coffee. Got it. But if you do coffee, what?
Do coffee, that like sounds like any other drug you do.
That is exactly what it is. It is a drug, yes. Don't you know, it's coffee is like one of the worst drugs, isn't it?
If you do cocaine.
Have you ever done the history of, have you ever studied the history of coffee? It's fascinating.
No, actually.
Oh, it's fascinating. But literally, there were places, it was prohibited under acts of sedition because
really?
Coffee houses where people planned revolutions. It was like literally, yeah, fascinating. So much fun. History of, we can do this later. It's also, by the way, key to like Slichot and Tikkun Chatzot and stuff like that. Because all those things, like all these things that you're supposed to do in the middle of the night, they all became popular after the advent of coffee. There's a historian who basically claims that all these religious phenomena that we have that like talk about doing things in the middle of the night, the real technological innovation that allowed all them was coffee.
Coffee supposedly was created in Yemen.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. We can do this at some point. So much fun. My first year in Toronto, we did an 18-hour consecutive Shirim. I only do crazy things, but that was my idea. So I gave the coffee share at the 11 o'clock at night share after starting at 6 in the morning.
Well,
it was only university
at that
students
point,
by that point.
50% of their bloodstream, so they needed
to help. Well, it was only the university students, and it was the DLIC share. It was great. Okay, but what problems does the Tzor HaMoras solve? It's a very clever shot, right? Let's go through it. The Tzor HaMoras says, listen. Let's go through what he's really doing. He's saying, listen, the Psukim Shmot seem to say that something about Shemitah is for the poor people. But as we noted, it doesn't seem to be causative, right? And in Vayikra, it doesn't say that the poor people will eat. Who's going to eat in Vayikra?
Everybody.
So how does he solve that problem?
Everybody.
He says the poor people are going to eat as much as rich people.
Right. So he says, first of all, the rich and the poor are going to eat. So in what sense are we taking, or are we identifying the poor as the reason for Shemitah in Shemot?
They're going to get help in the future.
Exactly. He said, listen, here's how you read it. During Shemitah, everybody eats it. In what sense is Shemitah for the poor? Not that they're eating during Shemitah. Everyone's eating during Shemitah. But it teaches the rich people what it's like to be poor. So everybody eats, but the ultimate goal is the poor. That's the first very clever move he makes, which synthesizes by Yikra and Shemot.
But how does a rich person feel like they're poor if they're getting food?
Because there isn't.
For everybody.
So that's part of the problem. We'll leave aside the question of what it means you get food for 3 years. We'll leave that aside. But he's saying, realistically, you're not planting for 3 years. You wonder where your meal is going to come from. Right? So he solves that problem by saying, how do we deal with the fact that Shemot emphasizes the poor and Vayikra emphasizes that everybody eats? Answer, everybody eats as if they were poor to help the poor in the future. Right? So Vayikra tells you who eats during Shemitah. Shemot tells you the long-term benefits for the poor in society. That's problem one solved. Problem two, in what way is this a Shabbat LaHashem? Right? The Pesukim in Vayikra emphasizes it for God. Very good. Because by teaching you to be poor, what you're doing is you're teaching the rich people to feel their dependence on God, just like poor people do all the time. And what's going to help the poor in the future is everybody having that feeling of dependence on God. So therefore, he synthesizes the statement that everybody gets to eat with the fact that the poor are going to eat by saying, everybody feels like a poor person and eats equally so that you remember after Shemitah what it's like to be poor. And how does he synthesize the Shabbat LaHashem? By saying that the experience of being poor is the experience of knowing you're dependent on God. Right? And therefore, all these reasons are synthesized. Right?
Why do you go to Galut?
Why do you go to Galut? Because you're not recognizing God. You're not willing to feel dependent on God.
You're
right? So you're not building a society that's going to help the poor. Right?
That all sounds a lot worse than...
Right, exactly. You're not building a society in which people feel dependent on God and understand what it's like to be poor and will therefore be sympathetic to the poor, right? You're creating a non-theologically, non-morally centered society, right? That's a reason for Golos.
What about the last one that you have to appease
God? Oh, so he doesn't do that one. It's not. He doesn't synthesize everything. He synthesizes a few, right? Okay, good. So that is one of the synthesized positions. Okay, good. What else do we have? What other positions do we have? So other similar positions focus not on poverty per se, but you can see hints of this in earlier ones who say that the point isn't helping the poor per se, but is, right? Making you feel, right? What does Rashi say? Right? He says, Shalot kinog bahem kibala bayit. Right, that you'll stop acting like an owner of the land. Right, that's the point. That's what it means. When it says, what? Exactly, right. But what's Rashi's formulation? What is he, right? Rashi, Allah Torah, has a slightly different formulation. It's not just you'll remember God. Right, what does he add by saying you'll remember that you're not the balabayit, that you're not the owner of the land? Va'kol yu shavinba, and then everyone will be equals. Right, what's he really doing? Hold the thought, right? Hold the thought.
Yeah.
But what is he doing? He's basically, right, this is the Shor HaMor is basically a development of this, right? He's saying the point is, you remember you don't really own the land, and therefore everybody's equal, right? He doesn't get to the poor, but he's saying, right, recognizing you're not Balabayit, but God is, leads to equality, right? So there's a social component and a theological component, and the theological side leads to... Right, so the social component, right? So Rashi does seem to synthesize it as well. Okay, good. What other reasons do we have? What does the Chinuch say? I'll get back to the Marx question in a second, okay? As you can see, this is the first chapter when I gave last year Halach on the Free Market. First one, yeah.
I didn't know that yet.
That was my booklet, right? It's for my course. That's why I gave it to you.
I know. I was going to.
Oh, okay, fine. You didn't do it yet. That's fine. Okay, what other reasons do we have? Sefer HaChinuch. Ellie, what does the Chinuch say? The Chinuch gave several reasons. Right, you tell me you did all the sources. So good. What does the Chinuch say? What are the lessons the Shemitah is supposed to teach? The Chinuch was Dalit. Right, it was right towards the beginning. Here, I'll open it. You can say, I don't care if you stay there, but I can't. I love the fact that I can just remove the wall on my classroom. Yes. Yeah, okay, good. Chinuch, what does the Chinuch say? Okay, so look at it. You have it. Mishar Shei HaMitzvah. Right? First reason he gives is right. So the first thing is to remember Inyan Chidush HaOlam that God created the world, right, and therefore owns it. Okay, good. Now he adds a theological component to it that God created the world, and therefore you are denying the people who think that God didn't create the world, similar to Shabbat, right? It's a testament to fine. What else does he say? What's his other reason? One second. What's his other reason? First, give me his other reason. Liknot midat havatranut. To teach you to be... Very good. Now, so what does that do? By saying you should be mivater, that you should be, you shouldn't be, right, possessive. That's a good word. Right? What is he really saying there? Ah. But he's being careful, because what's he saying? He's saying it's not really about helping the poor. What is it about?
It's about helping yourself.
Right. It's about helping you not feel ownership. Now, so he is probably going to have a similar synthesis to Shor HaMor, which is the point is, but in a different way. It's not that it's that you're going to give to the poor. It's that you're going to stop feeling that you own everything, right?
It's more of an adam and
not adam. Yes, right? Meaning it will help the poor, because it will teach people to stop being possessive of what they own.
Teach you that God owns everything.
Right, but that's obviously related. But not being possessive is probably related to the theological side, which is exactly right. The third reason he says, "Oz yesh toelet acher nimtzav adam sheosif adam bitachon b'shem baruchu," and also it will teach you to trust God. Now, you could read the Chinuch as being additive, that there are three reasons: to remember that God created the world, to teach you to not be possessive, and to make you have faith in God, or you can say that what he's implying is that these work together, right? If you remember God created the world, then you'll have faith in him. And if you have faith in the fact that God created the world, you'll feel less possessive because it's not really yours. And if you're less possessive, you'll end up helping the poor, right? There's a way, there's a very logical way in which these sins are not just additive, right? Not just cumulative, but they are synthesized, right? And again, right? Yeah, synthetic, right? And if the more you think they're synthetic and you think that it's a hybrid, the more the contradictions we have in the psukim are easily solved. Because the whole point is different aspects work together, right? The theological works on the moral, works on the, right? Okay, good. What else did I give you? I gave you Siach Shaul, that's Rav Shaul Yisraeli.
Yes. Shmita is for, like, to remember forever.
One second.
If we have Shabbos, then we don't need that.
Really?
We already have Shabbos to remember the Hashem, right? So like,
you're right. We never need two reminders for anything.
Well,
never.
No, but every single week. We don't need
you're right. Out. You're right, Josh. I think, as I've seen how effective it is, right, we should get rid of either the Madrichim or your alarm clocks. Because you only need one thing to get you to Shacharis. Only one. Every day. Oh, Kasha, you had both and it didn't work. Not you personally, but I don't remember who was here when. But the point is, you know, multiple reminders. My God, it's not the end of the world.
Also, it's different between not working for a year and not working for one day.
Correct. And they're different. Lahavdil. You relive Pesach, the Exodus, once a year. You have a mitzvah to mention it every day. I'm mentioning every day. Why do I have to do it once a year? Because once a year you do it intensely, right? Again, we can get into the lumdas closer to Pesach. But the point is, once a year you relive it, you experience it, whatever, and every day you mention it, right?
But then on Shabbat,
that's not how things work. You're right. On your anniversary, you shouldn't do all the normal things you do to have a happy marriage. Like every day, you'd have energy, you talk to your wife, you say good morning. Yeah. On your anniversary, you're going out for dinner, it's intense. Don't say good morning, just rely on the...
We're going out for dinner, why do you say I love you?
Please, like, what, I need to give you a kiss on the way out the door? We're going out for dinner tonight. Things don't work that way, man. They reinforce each other. See, all the things we learn, marriage advice, waking up for chakras advice, they're all related, right? What? Don't worry, one second. In a second we'll do Marxist thought, and then we'll turn it into a university, and then you can figure it out, okay? Fine.
On the part of reason for a Marxist seminary. I'm saying, like, as long as, what exactly is the problem with, like, saying that there was a tunnel, got the same dedicated as milk, and whatnot?
We don't believe it.
Yeah, I know. But like, why are you just such like...
That's right, Ginsburg's job. That's why he gets philosophy.
I know.
That's right, Ginsburg's job. I don't know anything about philosophy. I know nothing. Nothing. No philosophy. But I remember my first year in Migdal, everyone was like, you don't know philosophy. You're like, Ginsburg teaches philosophy. I'm like, I have multiple degrees in philosophy. I have graduate degrees in philosophy. What are you talking about? It's like someone else teaches the class. That's not my job. Like, I don't, you know, like, I have any talk in philosophy. Right, because I'm going to solve the problem of whether the world is eternal and still have time to discuss Shemitah. No, that's not happening. What?
Oversimplified.
What is life? If Rabbi Ginsburg doesn't deal with it at some point, I can give it. But right now, I want to finish this, because Sukkot is in a few days, right? I want to get some, you know, come on.
You know that the YouTube channel over some fun.
No.
They like they have 15 minute videos.
I don't like things that are oversimplified. I like reading the long version, which is boring with footnotes, and I like reading all the footnotes.
Yeah, you wouldn't like this.
I have a very good friend, Rabbi Dr. Ari Lam, and at some point we were just talking about it, and she put it very well. I like boring articles. That's when you learn something. I totally agree with that sentiment. I mean, I find them interesting, but what most people find boring, I find interesting. Right, Ginsburg and I, this is why we swap books, because I read a lot of books. I go through them, you know, and then I need more, because, you know. You know.
Yeah, well,
gotta read it.
I'm asking, why does the
Because it's standard Jewish belief that the world was created by God, Yeah, and that you have to believe that,
yeah,
and that we don't like Aristotle's eternal world.
Yeah, but like a lot of other Jewish beliefs, you don't like other, like, what you
do. And this is an important one. I don't know. The Chinuch saw it in here. He probably learned it from Shabbat. Right? Like the Ibn Ezra does. Right? They did parallels with the Shabbat. Right? Right? Fine. You want that? The Ibn Ezra is the one who defends it. The Ibn Ezra is the one who says, how do you know that it's not just to believe that there is a God? But then the point of Shemitah is to remember that God created the world in 7 days, right? The Ibn Ezra tells you, who did the Ibn Ezra? Right? The Ibn Ezra that I gave you in Shmot, Perek Chaf, what is he commenting on?
He's commenting on the pasuk of the commandments of
Yes, he's commenting on the Aseret HaDibros, not on Shemitah, he's commenting on Shabbat. And what does he say in that context?
He says Shabbat is the land. Shemitah equals the Shabbat of the land for a year.
He says Ra'inu kishmata Shemitah dome l'Shabbat. Right? Shemitah is like Shabbat. Right? And therefore, so one of the things is to remember creation of the world. Now, in that context, he said something else, though. I gave it to you not for the creation of the world, but that is part of it. But he has another proof that Shemitah is about Torah, is about giving you time to learn Torah. What's his proof?
I don't remember that.
So his proof is that how do we culminate the year of Shemitah? How do we end the year of Shemitah? What's the graduation from Shemitah?
Oh, Yom Tov.
No, that's only seven every year. So every Shemitah. Every Shemitah, how does it end? What do we do, the Sukkot, immediately following every Shemitah? Did you pay attention in shul yesterday? So then don't blame me, because it was yesterday's parsha. What mitzvah in the long 30-plus of parsha, what is the one mitzvah that we talked about that you do? Hakel, thank you. We end every Shemitah with the Sukkot following... Well, I don't live in Israel. I also didn't listen to the parsha yesterday. Dear Shtayim Mikra. This is not an excuse. It was a short parsha. The shortest parsha. Literally. Shortest parsha of the entire year. My God. Okay. Yes, what is Hakel? The mitzvah that you read yesterday in Vayakel. Shlomo, what is it?
I don't remember.
Okay, so who remembers what we read yesterday? Very good. We end every Shemitah with the Sukkot following Shemitah. We have the king read the Torah to teach all of Klal Yisrael Torah. And the Ibn Ezra says, why? Because Shemitah is a year of Kollel. And after the Gantz Klal Yisrael learns Torah for a year, you finish it off with a big Simcha Torah. Right? Good. I said it in Yeshivas. You got the point? Fine.
That's just the Torah.
What?
That's just the Torah.
Right, but he proves it from Haskell. He says, why would it be that Shemitah culminates with a national reading of the Torah? Because it's a year that everyone was immersed in Torah, right? It was a year that everyone was immersed in Torah, so you finish it off, right? And there have been several articles written by academics who claim that this is where the Minhag came from, of Simchas Torah. Of Simchas Torah. Simchas Torah is a Minhag. Right? So several academics have said, where does it come from? Because in Bavel, the minhag was to finish the Torah every year. Right? But in Eretz Yisrael, how often do they finish the Torah? So technically it wasn't every 3 years. It was, as we have it, every 3.5 years. Which means that every other cycle, when did they finish? On Sukkot of the year after Shemitah. Right? And therefore, several academics have argued that Simchat Torah is a minhag which developed to remember Hakel based on the minhag of Eretz Yisrael, which every other year finished the Torah, every other cycle rather, finished the Torah at Sukkot, the year after Shemitah. And just like we had a national celebration of the Torah, right, with Hakel, so we took that minhag and brought it down to the average Jew every single year, modeled after the Minhag Bavel, where we read the whole Torah every year. Right?
Do we know how they divided the parashiyos and it was just all...
Yossi Ofer has done all his academic work on this. You can go online to Yossi Ofer's TV, and he'll tell you everything you ever wanted to know about Kriyat Torah, Haftarah, everything you ever wanted to know, didn't know you wanted to know, right? But everything, he did his work on it. It's unbelievable.
That's
how... To just Google it. Yosef Ofer, or whatever. Most of it's in Hebrew. All of it's in Hebrew. But whatever. Good stuff. Whenever I have any question on any of this stuff, I just go to his CV. He has links to most of his articles. Yeah. I appreciate people like that being in the world. I could never do that. I couldn't sit there and do that, but I appreciate there are people like that in the world. It's like philologists. I'm glad they exist in the world for when I have a question about a word, but I would kill myself if that's what I did for a living. I really would. I can't. You know, at YU, in the graduate school, there's a professor. He's like an excellent philologist, but he literally wrote a 2-volume book on the letter Shin. I mean, or Sadi. One volume on Shin, 2 volumes on Sadi, or the other way around. I don't remember. It's not the type of stuff I understand.
Is that something actually I find fascinating in the world? And how they discover how things are pronounced?
Yes, it is fascinating. Like I said, I'm thrilled that these people exist and they do the work and I trust them. I just can't do it. You know. My professors in YU, it was like certain ones of them had interesting dissertations and certain of them literally banned us from ever reading their dissertations. Like, you will die of boredom. You know. Yeah, I had one professor who said, never read my dissertation. It was 560 pages or something, just on light metaphors in Yeshayahu. Which was not as bad as the assistant dean at the time, Professor Kohler, who his dissertation is over 700 pages on the nouns and verbs related to cutting instruments in Akkadian. Oh, joy!
Even you have reading
standards. I was like, I will read dissertations for fun. I really will. But those are not, I will read dissertations that are boring. Those I will just take the conclusions. I can't.
I can't read it.
Yeah, not that boring. There's a Madrega of boring, right? Like, there's a Madrega. That's the Madrega. I'm not at that Madrega. I can't read that. I can't do it. I really appreciate the people who can. I can't do it. I don't have that.
Because
there are people who find this interesting. There are many things I find interesting that other people don't. But that I can't do. I can't do it.
Like
fine.
500 pages on lightning metaphor that you're so young.
Professor Astor was a great professor. That was why he, and his class was very interesting. He just told us never to read his dissertation. I appreciate it. I didn't, you know. Fine. Good. Fine. We've done like 5-6 reasons. Rav Yisraeli gives another possibility, and he argues that the key to understanding Shemitah, what does he say in Sir Shaul and Vav? So he says, Dugmat Shabbat Bereshit. It is like Shabbat, but what's the difference? This is Josh's question. We already have Shabbat. Why do you need Shemitah? So one answer is my sort of, we always need extra reminders. But Rav Shaul Yisraeli actually dealt with your question directly. And what does he say? It's like Shabbat, but it's not like Shabbat. In what way? He says Shabbat represents the covenant that we have with God as individuals. Kifrat.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Kifrat. But Shemitah, which is on the national scale, what does it represent? Our covenant as a nation. Meaning, Shabbat is the Shabbat of people. Shemitah is the Shabbat of a nation. That's the difference.
Which raises the question, what's the Yovel?
Yes. In this piece, he's not dealing with it, but what does he use this to explain? Right? Meaning, he says it reminds us of everything about God and renews our covenant with God as a nation. Why does he, what drives him to explain it that way?
Perhaps the verse is talking about how everyone should be together.
Sure, and what else? Right, everyone eats together, and? Very good, the punishment. He says, why is the proper punishment for Shemitah, Galut? Well, he says Galut is a national, right? It's kicking out a nation from its land. So if the crime has to fit the, right, if the punishment has to fit the crime, then it must be that the crime was a national abandonment of their connection to God in the land, and therefore the punishment is The nation being kicked out of the land.
Shabbos was the creation of man.
Death penalty.
So,
what does he do it on?
You get killed.
So that's
Shabbat is death.
But I think that it's because on Shabbat it's what happened like to call it strange what happened to Shabbat, because Shabbat it was creation of man and rest, and I think Shemitah is more like we accept upon ourselves as a nation to go into Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah, right. There are different ways you could take it for sure.
I still don't know yet.
Okay. I will just note, we didn't do this Mechilta, but I'll just say it outside, right? The Mechilta does focus a little bit on the strength of the land, but in the opposite way of the Rambam, right? Meaning, basically, right, the Rambam says, oh, it's natural. The land needs to lie fallow. He says, no. The Mechilta says, naturally, how often does the land have to lie fallow? Every other year, right? He says, if you keep Shemitah, Hashem will create like an ace, and you'll only have to leave it fallow every 7 years. Now, that's not like the Rambam. Right, that's saying, if you do the mitzvah, God will reward you by making you have to leave it fallow less. That doesn't mean that the point was to leave it fallow.
And then it makes
right?
it even stronger, the fact that you're spending 3 years on the 6 year is even more.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, good. Fine. So that's a bunch of different reasons. I just want to focus on, I'll briefly focus, right, so we've talked, again, let's review some of these, right, so again. We had the straight reasons to remember God created the world, to remember that you're dependent on God, to take care of the poor, to take care of the land, right? To teach you to not be possessive, to let you learn Torah. And then we've seen the synthesis, right? Like, you recognize that God owns the land, which makes you not possessive, which makes you take care of the poor. Or, if you, for 3 years, have to feel like a poor person, then you will feel dependence on God, and you'll take care of the poor in the future. And therefore, in practice, everyone eats, but the theological moral lessons together take care of the poor in the future, right? Or, right, in other sources you have this idea, I didn't give you, but the idea that it teaches balance, right? It teaches you the balance. So like, I'll read you here from, I think it's the Kli Yakars, or am I on the wrong side of the page? No, it's Akedah Yitzchak, rather. Kilo Shulchano Hine lihiyot avadim nimkarim l'adama, kim tachlit acher nechbad nifla mimenu. Shulim kavim v'adar raka de tzorach ochal nefesh. The point of Shemitah is to teach you that you don't just work to eat, right? You don't work just to eat. You work to have enough to eat so that you can do other things that are valuable, right? Which is, again, one of these synthesized positions, right? It teaches you Torah values. It teaches you balance, right? How much you're supposed to work, what you're working for. Okay. Now, again, the thing that we'll get into starting tomorrow is what we didn't really talk about now, but we talked about a little bit last time, was the balance between whether the chiyuv is on the person or the chiyuv is on the land, right? Which obviously different reasons here focus. The Rambam, that the land has to rest, focuses very much on the land. Most of the other rationales would suggest that it's more about the person, right? And we'll see tomorrow whether that actually plays out halachically, right? Okay. What I want to leave you with, since Moshe is apparently interested in it, right, is the... Very good. Is the economic side of it, okay?
It's going to be a joke, but I was actually going to say a joke, but it didn't come out, so I found it. I can't say it.
Go, say it.
I'm sorry.
So I will say as follows. Okay, if we wanted to now move from this and say, does this teach us anything about the economic system of the Torah in general? What I pointed out when I gave this course last year, very briefly, was that all the founding fathers of Zionism were very obsessed with the idea that the Torah has something unique to teach about economics. Most of their focus was on Yovel, not Shemitah, but Shemitah got in a little bit. So Herzl has a piece on Yovel where he says the lesson of Yovel is that you should be a Marxist. Obviously, that's wrong because he says, we will model our country on Yovel, which teaches Marxism, and therefore we don't believe in God, so we won't give the land back to their original owners.
Yeah.
To recognize God, we'll take all the land and give it to the government.
What?
Nice.
Yes, that's how Herzl got to socialism and Marxism from Shemitah and Yovel. Jabotinsky...
He used God to undermine God.
Sure. Jabotinsky, though, wrote an excellent article in Hayovel. Again, mostly focused on Yovel, but he does talk a little bit about Shemitah, where he has a very interesting claim. He deals with the question of, is the Jewish economic system socialist or capitalist? And his answer is nishtahin, right? Which he probably did actually say, because, you know, he spoke Yiddish, which I don't. But I know that phrase, which is neither here nor there, right? Which is, he says, it's neither fully socialist nor capitalist. But he argues, it is, if I had to pick one, which is it more? This is Jabotinsky's view.
Capitalist.
Capitalist. Jabotinsky says it's capitalist.
Capitalist because we constantly need to remind ourselves to give stuff.
So here's his basic argument. He says, this is his basic argument in a nutshell. He says, the fundamental insight of socialism is that the economic system should be set up prophylactically to prevent inequality. Like give a vaccine. Prevent someone from getting sick with the illness of inequality.
Okay.
Right? Prophylactic. Right?
Yeah.
The Torah doesn't believe that. Right? The Torah says...
Always poor people.
The Torah says there's always poor people. But what does it say? Don't let things get out of control. So every seventh year, if someone has been borrowing money, and then he just can't pay back, wipe away his loan. If he was so poor that he lost his land, so every 50 years, right, reset the system. He argues that what the Torah is fundamental, again, he doesn't believe in, he's not religious, and, right, there are some problems in it because of that. But he argues that the Torah is advocating for corrective capitalism. That basically, listen, in the 7 years and in the 50 years, you can make as much money as you want, right? You can build as much capital as you want. Even during Yovel, you only give back the land. But if you were phenomenally successful and managed to lease the land for 50 years, right, and you built up apartment buildings on it, right, and made billions of dollars, right, during Shemitah, during Yovel, what would you do? You give back the land so that people can start again. But what about all the money you made during Yovel? The year of Yovel, but 50 years of the Yovel. You keep it. Right? It's not like, it's not that you can't strive. It's not that you can't work. It's that.
What about all the other farms? Are there many people just not putting housing, like?
Not necessarily. For 50 years, might be dumb. But people don't. How many apartment buildings aren't torn down after 50 years?
Like, socially,
can you spend more than... Can I explain Jabotinsky first? Let me explain Jabotinsky. I'm not defending or attacking Jabotinsky. I'm explaining Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky argues that the fundamental insight of the Torah's economic system is that it allows people to work and strive and do different jobs. There's no problem with people becoming unequal, right? It doesn't say that there aren't poor people. There are poor people. It doesn't say that you rich people can't lend money to poor people and demand the money back, right? It totally recognizes there's a system of inequality. What it says is that periodically you need to make sure it doesn't get out of whack. So if there's someone who just can't get himself out of poverty and still owes money during Shemitah, you wipe it away, right? If someone has lost everything, so by Yovel, you give him back his land, right? And his argument is that the point of Shemitah and Yovel is to create a corrective capitalism, right? That basically, right, we let people function, right? We don't, again, his argument is that socialism, again, is prophylactic. It prevents poverty, right? Capitalism, in its purest form, doesn't care about inequality at all, right? Corrective capitalism says, listen, let people work, right? We're not stopping people from building wealth, right? We're not stopping people from becoming poor and failing, right? What we're doing is making sure that periodically we shake it up and we minimize the inequality that has been created. We give people back the ability to start again so that it isn't forever, right?
Yeah, but like why you say that, like a free market mindset is just like the opposite. Like it's not just about like how you treat, you know, other people, but like the idea of like, oh, the mindset of making money is like trying to make as much money as possible. Like I guess in a objective sort of way, right? Well, so like
I would argue
when you so like honestly as far as
again, corrective capitalism. This is how, again, I'm not defending Jabotinsky. I'm telling you what Jabotinsky thinks the message of Shemitah and Yovel is, which is that corrective,
it allows you to amass your own wealth while at the same time.
I mean, basically, right, look, I think he's definitely right in the sense that it's
more close to capitalism, or according to him.
Because he says the fundamental insight of socialism is that inequality shouldn't exist. The Torah never says that. The Torah says you shouldn't let equality get too bad, right? The difference is right? That it allows people to work in whatever job they want, make as much money as they want, right? Not, it's not, no matter what, how much you work, everyone is left with the same at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right? That's not, right? It's not. It doesn't believe that there can't be. It recognizes that there will be poor people and there'll be rich people and there will be, right? And it allows for that. It allows you to do whatever you want, right? It allows you to work as you want. You're right. It doesn't believe in an unfettered. So, now again, Jabotinsky is not religious, right? But Jabotinsky is not religious, right? But can you say something like Jabotinsky, which is, listen, the point of Shemitah and Yovel, and we saw some of this in the Parshim, is not to prevent you from working. It's, like as the Akedat Yitzchak said, it's to give you the right values. It's not that the right value is that there can't be inequality and you should only learn Torah all day. It's that every 7 years or every 50 years, we shake things up to remind you that you should have Torah as part of your life. How do we do that?
The primary reason isn't even to help people.
Well, again, you can have variations on this, right?
I mean,
The Akedat Yitzchak is about teaching values. For Jabotinsky, it's about making sure that capitalism doesn't get out of whack, right?
Yeah.
But, again, you're not writing from a religious perspective. Again, I'm not telling you, Jabotinsky, Harav HaGoyin, right? We should reject all the Rishonim and just follow Jabotinsky. That's not what I'm saying, right? That was my class was not why Jabotinsky is right about all things, right? It was not that. It was, this class was called, right, Yovel and the Torah's unique economic vision. And it was, does the Torah have something unique to say about economics, right? And it was pointing out that Jabotinsky believed yes, right? That was the point of this. It was not, right? Other people say this too, right? Now, you know, and in that class, I also gave a page from the book Created Equal by Professor Josh Furman, who comes once a year here. He's great. Guys always love him. The professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan. He's great. He's unbelievable. He comes once a year, and it's a fun session. He doesn't lecture. He gives you a bunch of readings, right, like 8-9 articles of his, which you read in advance, and then he just does a question-answer on the assumption that you guys actually read what he wrote. It's great. It was so much fun. It was really, really fun last year. Okay, I mean, I'll read you what he says, right? A ubiquitous feature of the socioeconomic landscape of the ancient Near East was the danger the common man faced of falling into irreversible insolvency. Social stratification emerged as free citizens lost control over their means of production. A common pattern of this process was as follows. A peasant, a small landowner, resides on a small plot of privately owned lands and engages in subsistence farming. As his margins of profits are slim, he can go into debt for any number of reasons, personal illness, crop failure, taxation, or monopoly of resources by the state or private elite. His first line of recourse is to procure a loan, which he can only get at high interest. The high interest renders him insolvent, so he's forced to sell or deliver family members into debt slavery to pay off the debt. When this does not secure the means to pay off the debt, he has to resort to relinquishing or selling his own land, his means of production, and finally selling himself. Thus, he is compelled to enter the service of the state or some arrangement of feudal sharecropping for the land-owning elite. Indeed, records of debt slavery in Mesopotamia emerge as early as the Ur, the Third Period, in 2050 to 1955 BCE, and the institution was a permanent feature of the socioeconomic landscape of the ancient Near East. To counter this cycle, the biblical laws introduce a series of legal and conceptual reforms that together seek to achieve social equality, but of a very specific kind. It is not the egalitarianism developed since the French Revolution with its emphasis on the individual and inalienable human rights, nor does this equality manifest itself in family organization, size of holding, or amounts of production. Rather, it takes the form of an economic system that seeks equality by granting communal and divine legitimation to respective households that assist one another in agrarian labor and granting relief to other households in need. It envisions an association of free farmers and herdsmen subsumed within a single social class, where the common ownership of the means of production is vested within extended kinship groups. It is a system that rejects both statism and feudalism. Its rejection of statism is manifest in the fact that it is virtually tribute-free. Israel defined itself, according to the Pentateuch, in opposition to the empire of oppression, Egypt, but also in opposition to the centralized bureaucratic states that populated the land of Israel, etc. While these laws of a social orientation, they are intimately bound up in theological notions as well. Only by appreciating the theology that stands behind these laws will be able to fully construe their social implications. The economic policies that distinguish Pentateuchal law from the norms of the ancient Near East were deep reflections of the theological differences outlined, etc., meaning that there's one God, right? A second theological postulate is that God is the liberator of slaves, right? And then he basically says, how does this happen, right? So what does he do? How does it do this? And then he argues that basically the point of the Torah is to set up an economic system that has a theological and social equality. Again, not the ability for there to be inequality, but sort of protect it. Through what laws? Land tenure, the mitzvah of ma'aser, of tithing, the prohibition against borrowing with interest, right? Shemitah, Yovel, debt relief, land remission, and manumission of debt service, right? So he argues that if you go through all the laws, what they're doing is creating a theological and, right, economic system that basically emphasizes the fact that God is king, no person is lord over the other, right, tries to prevent things from getting going crazy, and he develops a theological, social vision based on this. You can read it more over there, okay? That I think, is a brief overview. Again, not of all the reasons of Shemitah, but of some of the individual reasons, how they emerge in the Pesukim, some of the hybrid reasons, what it tells us about theology, what it tells us about economics, what it tells us about personal growth, right? Can you raise questions on this? Of course. We just did like 10 different reasons. Yes.
When you said that, like, in this view, that a rabbi or someone that, you know, knows a lot of Torah would have a higher status, or would he just be participating in social equality?
No, this is nothing about Torah, right? Right? Scholarship is not relevant in this particular system.
It's not?
Excuse me.
Okay.
Okay, good. Fine. So that's a little bit of an overview. Again, what we're going to do tomorrow, and hopefully we'll finish this before Yom Kippur, is the question of, right, move from pure philosophy to the nature of the halacha. Again, the main question we're going to deal with, and again, I did not give you all the makarot. I gave you a sampling of relevant makarot. If you guys feel like you finished all the makarot, then, as you will quickly learn, I will give you the makarot I have collected myself. I gave you one or two nafkaminas and one achron that talked about it. If you finish all the card I gave you, I will happily give you another 15 pages of achronim that deal with more nafkaminas, and then that's fine. But the question we're going to deal with is, again, we notice that in some of the pesukim it focuses on the responsibilities of the people, in some it focuses on the responsibilities of the land, and we're going to try to deal with the balance of those two. Okay? That's our goal for the next 2 days, I guess, right? Which will take us to Yom Kippur.